Thank you all for joining our call today for a discussion with Jeb Hensarling. I am Jill Orlando, Relationship Manager with Chance Mantillon Group, for our podcast series, Relentless Pursuit with the Chance Mantillon Group. Now I would like to introduce Andrew Chance to begin the call.
Thank you, Jill. Thanks to everyone on the call and listening to our podcast. I'm very happy to be speaking with Jeb Hensarling today. Jeb is a managing director and executive vice chairman here at UBS, and he has the role of helping our senior leadership and clients evaluate political risks and think about how public policy may impact businesses and portfolios. Jeb's uniquely suited for this role, and one of the reasons we're so excited that we get to talk to him. As prior to joining UBS in 2019, Jeb served in the U.S. Congress for 8 terms, including 3 terms as chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and has a great deal of experience in many aspects of government that I think are going to be interesting to our friends and clients on the call today. So Jeb's going to share thoughts on a few different topics that we've heard are on everyone's mind. Before I start asking questions, Jeb, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, I'm very happy to do it. Very happy to do it.
Excellent. So obviously the events that are occurring in Ukraine and the Russian invasion are on the news every day. We see them. They've injected volatility into the markets. You know, when in our conversations, I know you have some background with NATO, and obviously your position in the government has made you privy to some information that not everyone has. Based on your experience, where do you see this going next, and what are some of the effects that are going to happen for our clients?
Well, Andrew, it's a great question. It's kind of the question of the day. A lot of opinions out there, as you point out, mine's kind of based on serving 8 terms in Congress, receiving a number of classified briefings from the NSA, the CIA, the Pentagon, having traveled to NATO headquarters to meet with our leadership, traveling to the EU to meet our leadership there, and several heads of state of NATO countries. So that's what informs my opinion. That, and still speaking to former colleagues, since I did leave Congress in January of 19 and joined UBS. So one, Andrew, there are a wide range of scenarios and outcomes, just a wide range. Let me go through a couple of kind of fortunately low probability scenarios. Number one, I'd say low probability that you will see Russia purposely cross a NATO boundary line with kinetic warfare. Why? One, as you well know, everybody knows by now, the Russian army has underperformed. Putin had many goals, and by the way, as an aside, he views himself as kind of a historic figure who's called upon to reconstitute Imperial Russia. But one of his aims with his second invasion of the Ukraine was to divide NATO, specifically to cleave off Germany. Instead, his attack has really, you know, yielded the opposite result. So you combine those two. Although Putin would love next to go back and reclaim the Baltic countries, very low probability that's going to happen. Second of all, a lot of concern about the use of either chemical warfare or a tactical nuclear theater weapon. Again, not impossible, low probability because of the various aims that Putin has today, and based upon the reality of the combat, probably can achieve his aims today through the use of conventional warfare. And he knows at that point, although not well defined, he has crossed a boundary line that could indeed render significant damage to Russia. So again, I'm not saying they're impossible, lower probability. I would think what is really becoming somewhat clear, and I must emphasize, that Putin is the master of head fakes, misdirection. That although not one scenario is highly probable, of all the scenarios that are existent, probably the one that has the highest probability is that Putin, who is searching for some combination of territory, sovereignty, and neutrality, will expand his control over the Donbass region in the eastern part of Ukraine create a land bridge to the Crimea so that effectively he divides Ukraine. He solidifies his gains where there is a large population of ethnic Russians, Russian-speaking people, and that he seeks some type of neutrality out of Ukraine and a weakened Ukraine. And so we think the probability suggests that, and depending upon what happens in the ground, I fear that we will see this unfold, not in days, not in weeks, but months. So what are the implications? Number one, and you're clearly seeing this, so we are going to see commodity inflation, we're going to see energy inflation. We could see certain areas of global instability, particularly in the Mideast and North Africa, who are so dependent upon the grains that are coming out of Ukraine and Russia and have those supply lines that have now effectively been cut off. In the energy arena, I do think that with respect to kind of renewables and the climate change agenda, it may be one step forward, one step backwards. Some renewables will become more cost effective because of what's happening to carbon-based energy. I think you will see in the public policy arena greater subsidies for renewables. And I think on the kind of carbon-based energy front, you will see not necessarily a great amount of support, but I think a number of countries may put that portion of their climate agenda on pause. You have seen our president make a big commitment of LNG to Europe. And frankly, the producers of LNG today don't quite know how they're going to meet that. And so it will be very interesting to see going forward, will this administration really change a very ambitious climate agenda that they have? And it may take an intervening election before we know the answer to that. I said earlier, very low probability that you're going to see Russia cross a NATO boundary with kinetic warfare. It doesn't mean you won't see it cross with cyber warfare. And I must admit, when I left Congress in January of 2019, if you were to ask me what keeps you up at night, the cyber warfare capabilities of our global opponents would have certainly made the top three, four items that kept me up at night. I've been a little surprised that the cyber attacks on Ukraine, relative to what I thought I knew about Russia's capabilities, have been somewhat muted. On the other hand, we know it wasn't that long ago when surrogates of the Russian state closed down the Colonial Pipeline, a huge portion of our energy infrastructure. I mean, I guess it was about a week ago that President Biden warned about cyber attacks. I think you could certainly see cyber attacks that are significant to our financial sector, to our energy sector. Those could still occur. I would also say, Andrew, that trends we saw starting with the previous administration that were exacerbated by COVID and certainly exacerbated even more, and that is deglobalization. As you will see in the public policy arena, carrots and sticks, particularly in what are viewed as critical technologies, critical sectors, there will be public policy to kind of onshore, nearshore, diversify supply chains. That can certainly have an impact on global GDP. And I think you will see a greater emphasis now on regional trade, not global trade. Again, that can slice off a portion of global GDP growth. It could exacerbate the possibility of a recession in the Eurozone, which ultimately is going to impact us as well. And the last point I would make is whatever the probability is prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine of there being a monetary policy mistake with very adverse consequences on the U.S. economy. Whatever those probabilities were, they just increased and increased significantly because of the uncertainty around this geopolitical event.
There's so many follow-up questions that I have, Jeb. It's fantastic. So you said election. We're saving that for the end because everyone wants to have everyone's got election questions. So we're going to come back to that undoubtedly. Something that I've been thinking a lot about, and I'll consider myself the layman when it comes to thinking about these things, although I guess like everyone else, spent a lot of time thinking about it. In terms of public policy, when the president comes out and says something, right? Like, we're going to send a whole bunch of liquefied natural gas to Europe. Or I was fascinated by the discussions about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and the release of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve this morning, which sent me scrambling to Wikipedia to see, is that an actual thing? It turns out it is an actual thing, I think. It is an actual thing. But getting that hundreds of millions of barrels of oil out of the ground in this SPR and into people's hands seems like a bigger task. So when people make these presidents or even people in the government, when they talk about these things, are they aware of kind of the scale and the time frame that they'd be talking about? I mean, I would assume it would take years before you could deliver significant amounts of liquefied natural gas to Europe.
Well, so two ways to address this, your general proposition and then your more specific proposition about LNG. So when presidents make these announcements, sometimes they are aspirational. Sometimes they are attempting to use a bully pulpit to either encourage or to beat into submission some part of the economy to perform the way that the commander-in-chief wants it to perform. And then sometimes they are articulating actual powers that they have, typically yielded to them by Congress. So in the case of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, yes, the president has the power to tap that. So it's a huge salt dome in Louisiana where a gazillion gallons of petroleum have been pumped. So he can access that. I think over any kind of even short term, that is not going to have a huge impact on pricing, certainly not over any kind of medium or long term effort. Congress could force him to go to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's already been tapped twice in the last 2 years, I believe. I want to say the last time it might have been tapped was in November. So this is not unheard of. With respect to LNG, you know, LNG is not produced by Uncle Sam. You know, there's a lot of volatility in the pricing of oil and gas. And when COVID hit, for the first time, I believe, in history, the price of West Texas Intermediate was a negative number. So it has gone in 2 years from a negative number to over $100 a barrel. So incredible volatility. The people on this call may love the president's climate agenda. They may hate the president's climate agenda. They may be somewhere in between. But as part of his climate agenda, it will be more difficult to acquire capital and to develop traditional carbon-based energy. That's just a fact. And so if the president wants to incent more production of LNG, there is going to have to be a reexamination of either his agenda or the timing of the imposition of that agenda. And producers are going to be looking for long-term contracts in a market that is incredibly volatile, and they will want to make sure they have access to capital and that they're able to produce. And so, again, right now that might have been a little bit more aspirational. That is not, the president cannot unilaterally deliver that LNG. It's going to take cooperation, and he could change confidence in the marketplace, but I got to tell you, I'm not really seeing a significant change in tone, at least between now and the midterms. And we can go into that later.
I think that's a good idea. I had one more question, sort of a bridging question between Ukraine and, again, more public policy and one of our favorite topics, which is spending government money. This latest budget, I don't know, suggestion. I don't know what we're going to call this latest round. One of the things that's obviously being focused on now is the U.S. military and spending. And I don't know if you've got a personal thought on this or what you're hearing from your former colleagues, but are we spending enough money on the military as we go forward?
Well, as you know, I'm kind of out of the policy advocacy business, and I'm into the policy analysis and commentary business. So I have a private opinion that I suppose I will keep to myself. Let me observe this. It is now a widely held bipartisan view in Washington that defense budgets have to be plussed up. And particularly Putin has rattled the nuclear saber. And so there's an increased focus on kind of anti-ballistic missile defense for both kind of intercontinental ballistic missiles. As you probably know, North Korea, who is always saber rattling, has saber rattled again with an ICBM. There's certainly a broad consensus that our NATO forces have to be increased significantly. So, you know, I've been to NATO bases in Germany and in Poland, seen our presence in the Baltics. There's certainly going to be a plus up there as well. And the Pentagon, their greatest beef with Congress is that there is not greater long-term certainty of their budgets for purposes of defense contracting. And so I think you will see a longer-term commitment to plussed-up defense budgets. Now, I can tell you from history, as these budgets get plussed up, Congress does not engage in triage. This is going to inflate deficits even more that can have a significant impact on the inflation that the Fed is trying to rein in. But the short answer to your question is you will see defense budgets plussed up for quite some time. And it's going to be a boon to defense contractors. It's not just us beefing up defense, but you particularly see it in Europe. I got to tell you, in my entire congressional career, I never thought I'd see Germany commit to their 2% of GDP committed to defense. Germany has essentially done a 180. And as one European parliamentarian said, you need to understand, this is our 9/11. Now, many in the U.S. have been warning Europe in general, Germany in particular, there is a threat. They are now seeing the threat on their doorstep. So again, from an investment perspective, and it may be a crowded trade now, but I would say this, the defense sector is going to be doing very well for quite some time.
You've gone right to the next concept I was thinking about when you talked about deficits and you talked about inflation. There's some other analysts that we've spoken to on numerous occasions when clients are always concerned about the budget deficit and national debt. And we hear oftentimes that nobody in the government really thinks about it, right? That they've got this credit card and they're kind of spending this money. From your vantage point, from having been in the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and what are your observations in terms of how does Congress think about national debt and deficits? Is it something that they're concerned about? And where do you think that heads ultimately?
Well, Andrew, thinking about it and doing something about it are two different things. I would say, number one, that there is less concern in Congress than there was 8 to 10 years ago. And I don't have the polling numbers at my fingertips, but I'm not making it up, but I'm trying to do this from memory. Maybe 10 or 12 years ago, if you would poll the body politic in America, roughly 60-65% of Americans would say the deficit is one of the top three issues I care about. Fast forward to say shortly before this latest inflation spike, that has gone down from 60-65% down to about 40%. Dealing with the national debt, take my word for it, is very heavy political lifting. It's not easy. So point number one is, if the American people do not care passionately about the issue, I assure you their elected officials will not care passionately about it. Second point, a number, again, rewind 8-10 years ago, members of Congress were very concerned about the debt, particularly post-financial crisis. And there were warnings and warnings and warnings of inflation, but they did not occur. And so that caused some members of Congress to say, well, maybe the nexus is not there that I thought it was. Today, though, you're starting to see ticking up again. Well, wait a second. Maybe there is a nexus to all this federal spending and the inflation I see. Because we're having to go out into the markets and borrow money. And indeed, we are looking at the single largest monetary fiscal policy stimulus in the entire history of our country. Now, again, you may think it's too little. You may think it's too much. You might think it was wisely spent. Maybe you think it wasn't wisely spent. Bottom line is, there was roughly $6 trillion of Treasury debt that was floated, and the Fed bought a huge chunk of that, and they put it on their books. They inflated the monetary base. A lot of that ended up in the real economy. A lot of that still remains on their balance sheet. And pre-COVID, their balance sheet was at about $4.5 trillion, and now, last I looked, it's a hair under $9 trillion. So when you ask about what's, you know, is there concern? There is greater concern today than there has been in a while, but it still remains heavy lifting. And I served with four different Fed chairs when I was in Congress and had a good close working relationship with Chairman Powell because we overlapped as chairman. All four Fed chairs I served with said, our debt is unsustainable. And something that is unsustainable has a tendency to cease. Now, the dollar remains the world's reserve currency. We've got, again, a debt to GDP ratio over 120%, largest we've ever seen in our nation's history. But today, there is still great demand for our sovereign debt. But at some point, will bondholders revolt? At some point, will bondholders demand a much higher risk premium, which can lead to a really ugly spiral as interest rates increase and all of a sudden debt service starts to crowd out the defense spending, our social safety net. You could get to an ugly picture, but as long as bondholders believe that we are fully good for the debt, you can roll it over. So in the short term, I don't think this ugly debt is going to present itself. In the medium to long term, members of Congress may be forced to deal with this.
You mentioned the dollar as the reserve currency. Based on what's happened in the world recently, in your observations, do you think that there's any real challenge to that in even the distant future?
In the distant future, yes. I don't think we're going to be supplanted by the euro. I don't think we're going to be supplanted by the pound. I don't think we're going to be supplanted by the yen. But one day, could we be supplanted by the Chinese yuan? Answer, yes. I don't think it's going to happen any day soon, but it could happen. And I think it's something that policymakers, some know, more probably will know and focus upon. Again, I would say for some policymakers, because of this inflationary spike, which, by the way, is the number one issue among voters, period, paragraph. I think I have the quote right. Mark Twain, wit that he was, once said, in America, public opinion is everything. Some believe it to be the voice of God. I can assure you politicians look at their polling very, very carefully. And as voters start to connect federal spending debt with inflationary spikes, and knowing that losing our status as the world's reserve currency, and by the way, that process is going to be accelerated by Russia's invasion in Ukraine, when there will certainly be a greater incentive that already existed for some countries to de-dollarize, that process is going to be accelerated and exacerbated when you look at the various financial sanctions that have been imposed in Russia, and financial sanctions we've never seen before. So the answer to your question is certainly not an immediate threat. It would be years and years and years in the making. But at some point, if bondholders start to think that this debt to GDP ratio is not to my liking, and I'm going to demand a much higher risk premium. And then all of a sudden, our debt service goes up, our debt goes up, and you could see it really could lead to a real bad economic spiral downwards.
We're going to hope that we can steer clear of that, whoever's in charge at the time. You know, a bit of a sidebar. I was down in D.C. this past weekend, and I was at the display of democracy in the National Museum of American History, and they had a protesting sign that it was stenciled on there. Truckers ask, "What part does Nixon play in oil shortages?" And I thought it was interesting. I had to take a picture of that because I thought it was an interesting thing to think about. These things aren't necessarily new. So you did bring up China, one of our favorite topics from time to time. I always go back. I'm forgetting the person who wrote the book, but there was a book called The 100-Year Marathon, which was talking.
Oh, I read it.
There you go. I'm talking about the concept that China has this very long-term goal of becoming the top dog, so to speak. Has what's going on in Russia, has that sharpened our and also focus on China? Or do we have any sense that the Chinese are looking at this and you know, going to school on it, which I'm sure they are, in terms of how a world response might be to their, not necessarily actions towards Taiwan, but all the actions that they have in the South China Sea and other places around the world? Is this giving them pause, do we think? Or is it just, we'll see what happens?
Can I check the box, all of the above?
Of course.
Kind of give you my analysis here. One of the last official acts I had as a member of Congress was to head up a bipartisan delegation of members of Congress to China at the request of the Speaker of the House. And we met, with the exception of President Xi, we met with all the high-ranking Chinese officials. And so to punctuate what you said earlier, it is absolutely crystal clear that they wish to be the dominant military power, economic power, technological power in the world. And in America, and this is a critique, it's an observation and critique, on our best day, public policymakers can think through a two-year election cycle. In China, they are thinking generationally. And you have to know that when you deal with them. But they're also patient. A very patient people. And you can afford to be patient when you live in an authoritarian state because you really don't have that much purview to protest or go your own direction. So here's where China is. China does want to support Russia because they want the U.S. to fight a political battle on an Eastern front and a Western front. They don't want the U.S. to be solely focused on China. China also wants to transform their economy, notwithstanding the fact their wealth, their great leap forward, if you will, came from trade with the West. They now want to transform the economy to one that is based on domestic consumption, but that doesn't happen overnight. And they have been hurt by the trade war of the previous administration. So they still need trade with the West. They still need trade with the U.S. So we are in this kind of embryonic kind of economic Cold War with China. They don't want to see that accelerated in the short term. They do not want various financial institutions, state-owned enterprises, to receive secondary sanctions. And listen, I was chairman of the House Financial Services Committee when we imposed the last sanctions on Russia. Those pale in comparison to what we are imposing today. So China would prefer not to be subject to these secondary sanctions now. In addition, they know that 90% of the world is aligned against Russia. They prefer it not to be aligned against China. As they attempt to take the prime position on the global stage, as they attempt to be really the economic benefactor of emerging markets. But again, they are conflicted because they want Russia to take attention and resources away. Now, China has helped Iran evade sanctions. They've helped North Korea evade sanctions. But now we're talking about the 11th largest economy in the world. And you can't flip a switch and just take all that fuel and all that grain. My best opinion that I would offer is that China is going to err on the side of helping Russia, and they will gamble on getting further sanctions. And so, Andrew, I'd say my point is, and I made it earlier, kind of the trend of deglobalization will continue and really be accelerated, and trade tensions with China are going to get worse. The only exception would be some kind of real verifiable commitment to force Russia to the bargaining table at an acceptable agreement, something big and verifiable in the climate change space. Outside of that, I think our trade battle with China is only going to get worse.
Okay, that's somewhat sobering news. We did promise that we would ask what you see about midterm elections. And I thought you had some funny comments when I asked you in our prep call about perhaps we think more about midterm elections than even congressmen think about midterm elections.
I didn't remember being funny in that call, but I'll take your word for it. No. Listen. When you're a member of Congress, after you declare election victory in one election, you're already working on the next. I assure you it never goes away. So as of today, Republicans stand an excellent chance of taking the House. The Senate is a little bit more of a coin toss. And I would say the implications of that, if Republicans take one House, the Biden legislative agenda, and I emphasize the word legislative, it pretty well comes to a complete halt. And you would have pretty much stagnated legislative environment, which by and large, historically, markets like, because as you well know, markets dislike uncertainty. Stagnation is at least certainty. But to make the previous point, the Biden administrative agenda doesn't go away. And just like in our conversation in the context of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, there are still vast powers within the executive branch, particularly among kind of the alphabet soup agencies of government. So there's still a fair amount of the president's climate change agenda and agenda within the financial sector that would go forward should Republicans take one House or the other and his legislative agenda is stymied. And as an aside, I've never known a political party attempt a more ambitious agenda with a thinner majority than this one. So he hasn't just been stymied by Republicans. It takes one moderate Democrat senator, in this case, Senator Manchin, to stymie really the president's broader agenda. But back to the election, just quickly, Republicans stand an excellent chance of taking the House for several different reasons. Number one, history. I think I have this right. If you look at the last 50 midterm elections, the president in office lost seats 46, 47 out of those 50 elections. Huge historic tie. The average loss is roughly 22, 23 seats. Democrats hold a 5-seat majority. Okay. You lose 5 seats, the House flips. So you've got history. Second of all, you mentioned President Nixon earlier. President Biden's numbers are not Nixonian, but they're poor. They are not good. I mean, the latest NBC poll, 40% approved, 55% disapproved. Just take my word for it. If you're a member of the House, your campaign fortunes are greatly tied to the approval rating of the president in the Oval Office. It's just hard to escape that. And again, the president's numbers, right, wrong, or indifferent, the buck stops with him. His numbers are quite poor, not just with the American populace in general, but if you look at key demographic groups that are important to Democratic Party success, and be that younger people, that women, certain ethnic minorities, his numbers are down either mid-single digits or in a couple of cases, very, very low double digits. Then if you look at the issue matrix of issues that Americans care about, inflation, number one, the president has terrible approval rating there. And in fact, about the only issue that I see that the American people care about that the president has good numbers on, that is COVID. Today, he has good COVID numbers. The next issue, this is a reapportionment redistricting year. Okay. There are some states that have independent commissions draw congressional boundary lines. Most states, it's a function of state government, state legislatures, governors. Bottom line is you have more map drawing pins in the hands of Republicans than you do Democrats. No shock here. Democrats draw congressional maps to benefit Democrats. Republicans draw congressional maps to benefit Republicans. You've got more of those map drawing pins in Republican hands. Next, it is a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, but when members of Congress think that their party is going to lose control, they start to announce retirements. Again, take my word for it. There's nothing more irrelevant in Washington than a minority member of the House of Representatives. Okay, today you have almost, last I looked, 3-1 Democrat retirements over Republican retirements. It's almost universally easier for a party to keep a seat held by an incumbent than it is what we call an open seat. So that's one more reason. It's an indicator of which way the election is going to go. Now, can Democrats turn this around? Sure. But it would probably take a real rally round the flag moment. President Biden and President Zelensky holding hands together as Putin retreats. It would take a really dramatic decrease in inflation. It would take COVID just getting off the radar screen. It would take Republicans making mistakes and certainly conflict between President Trump, kind of Trump supporters, other people in the party. That kind of Republican bad press could help the Democrats. And there is one X factor. The Supreme Court has before it two different cases that could dramatically change Roe v. Wade. And depending upon what the Supreme Court rules, and those rulings will probably come out late June, that could potentially kind of awaken a sleeping giant with the Democrat Party base, which today is not enthusiastic. There's a real enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats. So, you know, watch the Supreme Court in June. That could kind of be an X factor. Republicans could snatch defeat from the clutches of victory. But right now, it's not looking good for the Democrats to hold on to the House.
Interesting. Two more questions. You've been very generous with your time, and a lot of our callers know that I could probably sit here and talk to you for about 4 more hours. But would you care to handicap President Biden's second run as president, whether it happens or not?
So I don't know President Biden. I mean, I shook his hand a few times. When I was in office, I had far more dealings with President Obama than I did then to Vice President Biden. And the people I speak to, I think most believe he will be a one-term president simply because of his age. My guess is he knows it. Rarely do political figures, even if they intend to retire, publicly announce it. You know, it's a little bit like Superman and Kryptonite. Once you announce you're retiring, little by little, your power just starts to devolve and evaporate. So I also think one of the reasons the president has signed on to such an ambitious agenda, because he probably views himself as a one-term president. And so he views himself as probably having one term to achieve his legislative ambitions, his place in history. And today, I think he pretty well knows it may be one term. I mean, he's got 2 years to get it done if he's on the precipice of perhaps losing the House. You know, I have some clarity in my crystal ball for the 22 election. There's certainly less clarity for the 24. I mean, anything could happen. I mean, again, George W. Bush had a 91% approval rating after Desert Storm and lost his reelection campaign. So certainly by 24, the president's fortunes could completely turn around. I mean, having, again, his numbers dramatically changed between now and November, a little bit problematic. But I think the conventional wisdom in Washington is that he will probably be a one-term president, probably not seek reelection.
Okay. Last question. Is there a secret thing that we don't know about being a congressman, a member of Congress, that you find that was interesting? Was there a surprise when you got there? Is there, what does the ordinary American not know about having that seat?
Well, we don't have 4 hours. So, you know, I would say, and I guess this is somewhat in defense of my old profession, I must admit, some of the worst and some of the best people I've ever met in my life served in the U.S. Congress. But I did get, it was somewhat draining of how many people believe anything they see on the internet. So are there some perks in serving in Congress? Answer, yes. This may not be answering your question. But when I would go to town hall meetings and say, in here, why don't you people pay Social Security? I got to the point where I took my pay stub. We pay Social Security. And then I would go and, well, you guys wrote yourselves out of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. No, we're the only federal employees in there. You serve one term and you get 100% pension. No. Here's a copy of the pension. I must admit, there are thoughts that people have. Yeah, one time I had a really nice parking slot at Reagan National Airport. So that was a perk. I guess getting a little bit more serious about your question, again, I served with some really great people, but you need to know good, bad, or indifferent. You know, elections have consequences, but what comes out of Washington is really not based on majority rule. It's based on a very vocal, intense minority. It is the politically active that rule the politically inactive. And if you are concerned about the division within America and the polarization, if you are not involved in a political party's primary process, then you kind of have to look yourself in the mirror, and at least that helps explain why are you getting such dramatic partisanship. I would also say that what some people don't understand is, to some extent, how much less their vote counts today than maybe it did 20 or 30 years ago. I kind of alluded to it, but as the decades have gone by, more and more Congresses have yielded more and more power to the executive branch. And so your franchise is not as important as it once was, number one, for Congress, because there's simply far less power in Congress because it has been yielded towards others. So there's a big debate about voting rights, and you may be on one side of the debate, you may be on the other. But there's an aspect of voting rights that I don't think the American people appreciate, and that is, you're a member of Congress, that vote just doesn't count as much as it did decades ago. And so there's a lot more lawmaking from the unelected, unaccountable branch of government in the EPA and the CFPB and the FDIC and the FERC and kind of the alphabet soup of government. So one thing you need to know about Congress is it's not as powerful as it once was. So those are just a couple of observations. One, yeah, we had some perks, not as many as you thought. Number two, it's not majority rule. It is ruled by intense minorities, by trade associations, by, again, issue advocacy groups. So in that way, democracy works if you participate in democracy beyond voting. If you only participate in democracy by voting, some would argue it doesn't work quite as well. And then you just need to know that, again, the people you elect simply cannot be accountable because they have yielded so much power to others. Again, we could go on for hours. I could pull behind the curtain, but those are just a couple of random observations.
I think those are actually fantastic observations, Jeb. I don't know if you intended this, but it made me think of the local school board meetings, right? Where a vocal few can cause big changes in terms of what's going on. I really appreciate your time this afternoon. That was absolutely fascinating. And the fact that your vote doesn't count quite as much is an interesting takeaway thought. And get involved, right?
Well, if I could just leave on one final note.
Of course.
And that is, didn't want to depress everybody, but there are serious issues our country is facing. But I got to tell you, if you look at the expanse of history, America has overcome far, far greater challenges than what we are facing today. And if you think politics is acrimonious today, pick up a few biographies of Hamilton and Jefferson and Washington. It was just brutal, absolutely brutal. Politics was more brutal. The economy was more brittle. In some respects, there were fewer economic opportunities. So I wanted to point out, yes, we have some great challenges, and also say there are great opportunities. But you got to get involved. Democracy is a participatory sport. I guess I don't really have on my UBS hat now. Maybe this is my former member of Congress. But again, democracy is a participatory sport. It doesn't really work unless people engage in it and take time to really understand the issues. But I also want people to know, on both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, there are some really great people who love their country, trying to do the right thing. Yes, there are lazy, no good scoundrels as well. But there's also some really good people trying to do the right thing and could really use participation in support of the democratic process. So again, that's probably not what people came onto this call to hear, but I didn't want to leave people down. And I would also say, when you look at geopolitical events, as terrible as they are, and I don't mean to make light of the human misery, typically within some period of months, markets recover. And as of today, investors ought to be keeping a closer eye on the Federal Reserve than they ought to be keeping on Russia and Ukraine, based on my opinion.
That's a perfect way to end it, Jeb. Can't do any better than that. I really appreciate your time, and thanks to everyone on the call. Jill, thanks for setting us up. I'm going to make the offer. We may ask you to come back in a couple of months.
I'd be happy to do it. Hope this was helpful to the clients on the call.
Awesome. Thank you, Jeb. Have a great day.